All right, joining us now is Eric Peters of ericpetersautos.com. Always great to talk to Eric. He shares my love of liberty as well as of cars and transportation and the freedom that comes with that mobility. But of course, now these car manufacturers a couple of years ago decided that it was more important for them to follow the ESG guidelines and to become mobility companies than to focus on selling cars. I guess they thought the payoff for being a stakeholder was going to get to be the rent it by the ride thing, as Eric and I have talked about so many times. Always good to have you on, Eric. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, David. And maybe they didn't realize just how bad it was going to get.
I know. They're bailing out.
Before we get into cars, I was listening to your program earlier, and you were talking about these anticipatory vaccines that they're talking about now. Well, that's a really, really interesting idea. Maybe I should go out and buy a set of new tires for my truck just in case it needs a tune-up a couple of months from now.
Yeah, they'll hold a gun to your head and make you buy some stuff. That's the thing that bothers me. It's bad enough that they're going to put out all these things as genetic things and say, yeah, we've demonstrated that we don't have to do any testing now. And then not only that, but, you know, we've got a whole bunch of these things out. But, you know, they're really only effective if we start them a couple months before disease X happens. So we don't know what the disease is. It hasn't affected anybody. But we're going to have you come in for mandatory vaccine. And isn't that what 2020 was really like? Nobody had died when they declared the emergencies. We had one declared at the end of January by Trump's big pharma HHS head, Alex Azar. And then when Trump did it in the middle of March, nobody had really died of any of this stuff, right? It was nothing. Yep. It certainly wasn't an epidemic anywhere, let alone a pandemic. It was a pandemic of global governance is what it was.
The intellectual philosophical pirouetting that was done too is just astounding to behold. You know, on the one hand, as long as it was Trump's vaccine, it was bad. But when it became Biden's vaccine, all of a sudden it became good. Eurasia, we're at war with Eurasia. We've always been at war with Eurasia.
And then it flipped the other way. As soon as Biden gets in, you know, all the conservative commentators hate it. Mark Levin was pretty slow catching on, though. You know, he was at the beginning of 2021 in January. He was still on there telling Trump, you got to take a ticker tape parade for this. It's your accomplishment. Don't let Biden take this from you. And it took him a very long time to start calling it evil. After, you know, we had to have a sufficient amount of time for Trump to be gone before he could start calling it evil. But they still won't lay it at his feet, you know, this thing that he continues to brag about. It is amazing how both sides are like that. You can't take that. That's Trump's vaccine. Or now it's it's a bad thing, but it's Biden's vaccine. And that's why it's bad.
It makes me want to jump in my old muscle car and just go for a very long, long drive.
That's right. Yeah, let's talk about what's happening with these companies again. You know, we were last time we spoke, Ford was having second thoughts about this and shutting things down. Many of them, GM, first it began with their autonomous self-driving issues. They started shutting those things down. Then it began with nobody wants to buy my product. I'm going to be out of business. And before I can cash in on this selling people by the ride transportation, they're not going to make it to that point if they don't change.
Yeah, it turns out that if you build it, they won't necessarily come. One of the more interesting data points that's come out over the last couple of weeks is that in California, of all places, the epicenter of EV fever, EV sales generally, not just Tesla, but across the board, have been down now for two consecutive quarters. And I think that is a very fascinating bellwether because, again, the majority of EVs that have been registered, a bulk of them, probably about 2 of the 6% total, at least, are in California. And there are reasons for that. Now, you know, California is, generally speaking, an optimal place for an EV because it, generally speaking, doesn't get too hot. It doesn't get too cold. Mm-hmm. So you don't suffer the range depletion issue that you tend to suffer if, you live in Chicago or Maine or any other place that has winter. And of course, it skews heavily to the left. And, for leftists, the electric car is a lot like wearing a face diaper. It's a symbol of their virtue. And so a lot of early adoption. But even there, things are starting to dial back. And I think it's in part because people are beginning to find out, you know, this EV thing isn't all that it was advertised to be. But I think more fundamentally is that electric cars are fundamentally luxury cars. And what I mean by that is that they're priced at the same level as a luxury car. The typical transaction price of an electric car is approaching $50,000. There are only so many people who can buy a $50,000 car, period. Yeah. End of discussion. It doesn't matter what you think about electric cars. There's a reason why we have brands like Chevy, Honda, Toyota, Subaru, and so on, which comprise roughly about 80% of the new car market. And then you've got brands like Mercedes and BMW and Audi and Lexus, which are much, much smaller players if you look at the number of vehicles that they sell. And what do you suppose the reason for that is? Well, the reason is that those are luxury cars, and luxury cars cost thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars more than a Chevy or a Honda, period. Mm-hmm. That's why we're not all driving Mercedes and BMWs, because not all of us have the money to buy a car like that. And so I think what's happened in California is that the bulk of the people who want an EV in the first place and in the second place can afford one have already bought one.
Yeah.
And now that's it. And the really fun part is going to happen over the next couple of months, because normally in a market, if there were a slowdown of buying, there would be a slowdown of building. The manufacturers would respond to the decrease in demand with a decrease in production. But because they bought into this whole shibboleth, this whole idea of just making as many EVs as the government tells them to, they're going to churn these things out like Ford has been doing with the Lightning. And nobody's buying them. And they're just stacking up. And then what then? And it's going to be very interesting to see what then.
Well, I think what's going to happen is the government that they've been trying to serve, it's going to have their back. The government will bail them out. They'll say they're too big to fail. And they've bailed out the auto industry before, and especially would bail them out if they're trying to be good citizens and take away our choices to have anything except a battery-operated car. It was interesting to see, and you referenced it in your article, as you point out, a lot of these things are, even non-luxury brands like Honda, because Honda's got a luxury brand that they sell out there, but even their non-luxury items costing $50,000 or so. But Toyota taking the lead and saying, no, it's never going to be the majority. We have to have other ways to do this. And of course, even if you want to have an electric car, there's other ways to do an electric car, right? Fuel cells, hydrogen, other things like that you can have zero emission. And I think, as you and I have talked about for the longest time, the real agenda is very naked here, because they've got to have the battery grid operated car. They don't want people to be able to fuel up independent of their control grid. And that's the key thing. The electric grid is their opportunity for control. That's why they are so dogmatic about this, just like they were the vaccines. No, you can't have any other treatment. And once you start doing that, people start waking up. It's like when going back to the vaccine again. You had a lot of people who, at the beginning of this, people like Steve Kirsch, he's working with him. He's coming up with different things that he thinks are solutions. He believed in it enough that he got the vaccine, but he's also trying to come up with different approaches. And if you're saying that it's really a pandemic and he bought into that, then wouldn't you try everything that you could if it's a really serious threat? And when they said no, we're not going to try these other things, you can't do that. And it's like, what's going on with that? That doesn't make any sense. And so I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, if you're telling me that this is some kind of a climate emergency, then and you're not telling me that we can try everything to stop it, but we got to do one thing and only that thing. It's the same approach. It's always the same MacGuffin every time you turn around.
And something that speaks to this, I wrote an article about this the other day. On the one hand, you've got the government effectively mandating electric cars. But on the other hand, you've got the government effectively prohibiting affordable, practical electric cars. Yes. And what do I mean by that? It is essentially impossible to offer in this country the kinds of city car EVs that you can get in, of all places, the People's Republic of China and a number of other countries like that, where you can get a little EV that's kind of analogous to a moped. A lot of people will get themselves a moped or a scooter because all they're doing is knocking around their neighborhood or the city. They don't need to go out on the highway, so why would they go out and spend all that money on a vehicle with capability that they don't need? Well, there are a lot of people who would be able to make great use of a little city car. The problem is, in most states, you can't get a vehicle like that because it's illegal to operate it on the public roads. It has to meet all these cars, one size fits all, have to meet the same standards. So again, to get to your point about their motives, if these people really believe there was a great climate crisis and we've just got to get people as quickly as possible into these EVs, you'd think that they would do everything that they could to encourage people to be driving efficient, affordable little cars like that, that actually have a very small carbon footprint, to use their terminology, as opposed to these obscene 6,000 plus pound, $100,000 ultra luxury, ultra performance, gigantosaurus trucks like the Cybertruck, and the Rivian R1T and the Ford Lightning, just gratuitously, disgustingly wasteful of resources and energy and money. But it just tells you what they're really all about.
Those things are a crime against thermodynamics, aren't they?
they truly, really are. And also another point. against safety. A very interesting crash test study came out just the other day. It was done by the University of Nebraska, and they featured a Rivian R1T. I've got an article on my site about this, and you can view the actual video of the crash.
And Travis has that video up. And so go ahead and play that and let Eric talk about it, Travis. He pulled up the video that's on your site on the article that just hit today. Go ahead. Tell us about it. The Rivian. There you go. Okay.
Ooh, so it's a Rivian R1T, which is an electric pickup truck. And it's similar to the Ford Lightning, and it's similar to the Lightning in that both of these things weigh well over 6,000 pounds because they're carrying around 2,000 pounds of battery pack with them. Anyway, the study subjected one of these things to a crash test. They drove it into a guardrail, and it went through it like it was made out of tissue paper.
Yeah. And two different rows of concrete barriers as well.
If you think about the kinetic energy that a 6,200-pound vehicle has when it's going down the road at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, and it's not just the guardrail, it's going to hit you or me potentially in our vehicle.
That's right.
And you know the physical damage to property, not to mention what it's going to do in terms of getting people killed, is potentially staggering. And that, by the way, is why we're all seeing, you've got your latest insurance bill, you probably noticed it went up. And sure, part of that is inflation, but part of it is that these insurance companies, the rubber hits the road when these actuaries look at what they're paying out or what they're potentially going to be paying out in the future. And they understand that the cost of these things is going to be enormous, and somebody's got to pay for it. And that means you and me, even if we don't own an EV.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I guess they'll probably handle it, Eric, like One America handled the massive rise in deaths in third and fourth quarter of 2021, where they started really pushing out these vaccines. They said this is like more than 3 standard deviations away from the mean. This is like a once in every 200-year event. And the CEO says, well, even though they say that these people who died, these excess deaths were not from COVID, I know better. I know they were from COVID. He knows better. And he says, and furthermore, I know that you don't get COVID if you get the vaccine. So what we're looking at here really is deaths of unvaccinated people. So we're going to raise the rates on the unvaccinated people because they're the ones who are causing this. I mean, the logic that they will come through to excuse all of this stuff, and we'll see it with this stuff as well, because again, you know, the climate MacGuffin or the pandemic MacGuffin, they've got their end game that they're going to do. Whatever they need to scare you with, it doesn't matter. They just pull up a different MacGuffin to get to where they want to get, which is more money, more control.
The disingenuousness and the hypocrisy can also be seen in their feigned and pretended concern about safety. We've been hearing them warble about safety for as long as I've been alive, for 50 plus years. And yet, when we find out things about EVs that are demonstrably not safe, like their tendency to spontaneously combust, for example, or the fact that if you get hit by one, you're probably more likely to get killed than you would have been if you'd gotten hit by a car that weighed 2,000 pounds less, they're silent, they're mute. You know, there's no expression of great concern about that, which again, it's interesting because it shows it's not about safety. Safety, just like health, has always been just the MacGuffin, the excuse, the thing that they use to kind of lay a guilt trip on people. Well, you don't want people to die. You want things to be safe, you know, and therefore, you know, you should accept this. Here's our solution to keep you safe, to keep you healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you pointed out before, if they really do believe that we're all going to die because of CO2, then they would waive some of these mandates, something. And they just had yet another. You and I have been talking about this for years, since we first started talking. The Takata airbags. You know, more of these things are now standing out there. But at the beginning of this, when they first started putting the airbags out, they adamantly refused to allow people to turn these things off for years, even though it was admitted by them that it was very, very dangerous for smaller women and especially for children if they're in the front seat. But you're not going to be able to turn this thing off. I mean, it's all about their agenda and their control. And now their agenda is to control everything.
Yep. I have a friend, I can't mention his name, but this person worked for one of the major car companies. And at the time, he was involved in the development of the airbag to comply with the SRS supplemental restraint mandate. This is back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And he's told me personally about how the engineers went to NHTSA and explained that the standard as it existed for the unbuckled adult male passenger was going to result in women, old people, and children getting killed. And here's why. And they just explained the whole thing to them. The regulators did not care. Yeah. They just went ahead with the mandate knowing they had been apprised of the dangers. They were told this is going to happen. They didn't care. And so it happened. And so, you know, they're that flippant with people's lives. They're just that determined to pursue whatever their ideological end goal happens to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Volvo is backing off now. They're the latest ones. And that just came out yesterday. And you had an interesting name for their electric car. Tell people what that is.
The Polecat?
The Polecat.
The skunk? Yeah, Court Volvo, you know, which is no longer Swedish except in name only. Volvo is a Geely, which is a Chinese conglomerate. They had been hemorrhaging money on this Polestar spinoff that they were trying to launch, which was going to be their electric car, their high-end electric car division. And they've just not been able to make, not only have they not been able to make a go of it, they have been losing a tremendous amount of money. And so they finally had to pull the plug on this, just as Ford has had to shut down two out of the three production lines on the Lightning, because it's at a certain point, you just can't keep doing this. The money runs out. And I think that these car industries the car industry is beginning to realize this is an existential threat to them, just on an economic level, that this is not going to pan out. It's not going to work out well.
Yeah. Another one hit the dust yesterday as well. This is a company called Arrival, and they were cranking out vans for the likes of UPS. They had special cars that they had contracted to do for Uber, and they just had to lay off half of their workforce. They got delisted from NASDAQ this week. That's out of the UK. I mean, these things are dropping like flies everywhere. Truly is amazing.
Yeah, well, here's something that I think is going to also not end well. Honda is just now bringing to market its first electric car. It's called the Prologue, and it's essentially a rebadged GM electric car. They're buying it from General Motors. It's the Blazer. It's the Blazer electric car with a Honda badge on it that they're going to try to sell through their brand.
Bad timing.
Well, the thing of it is, it's almost $50,000 to start. Once again, I think its base price is $48,900, something like that, for a Honda.
Yeah,
$48,900 for, and what is it? It's another mid-sized crossover SUV. And if you look at the non-battery powered versions of those kinds of things, you can pick up one for $25,000. So who is going to go out and buy a $48,000-$49,000 electric version of the same thing? Who does that? Mm-hmm. Maybe Pete Buttigieg can do it because he's a government worker and he makes an astounding amount of money. But the average American family cannot do that. It's not sustainable. And I think it's going to be a disaster for Honda.
You know, it's interesting because it seems like they've pulled in pretty much every automaker, major automaker, except for Toyota. Maybe Mazda. Mazda hasn't really been doing anything with it. But they pulled in pretty much everybody in all of this, and they may wind up, Toyota may wind up, they're the biggest in terms of sales right now, right? They may wind up.
I'm not sure at the moment. Volkswagen Group may have surpassed them. I don't know, but they're right up there. It's one of the top.
And it wasn't that long ago that we were seeing all these pronouncements, probably about a year ago, one after another, these car companies were saying that by such and such a date, we're going to be 100% electric. And now a lot of these car companies are pulling back as part of the Volkswagen Group. Audi is pulling back from that as well.
They're having to.
Yeah.
You know, you can't keep stuffing this under the rug, almost literally. You know, like the case of the Lightning is illustrative. You had Ford shipping these things out to dealers, and the dealers were putting them on the lot, and they're just sitting there. And these, you know, just fleets of F-150 Lightnings just sitting there, and these dealers are screaming for mercy. Remember, I guess about a month or so ago, 4,000 of them signed an open letter to Ford management telling them, stop it already, enough. You know, we need vehicles that we can sell, not vehicles that we're carrying interest costs on, sitting on our lots collecting dust.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that God was laughing when this this snowstorm went through and stayed for the longest time throughout the United States, especially in places like Chicago.
That was a godsend. You know, sort of thing. It really helped to put in stark relief the reality of dealing with an electric vehicle and what you're signing up for when you buy one of these things. It's a lot like the vaccines. I've drawn parallels with that. You know, people were relentlessly lied to about the true nature of these things, not told about the downsides, the deficits, and it's just the same thing. It's tracking in exactly the same way. And the truth finally, just like with the vaccines, begins to leak out. And after a while, you reach kind of a critical mass point, I think, where it just sorts, it gels and people get it. And they realize, you know, I want no part of this, whether it's, you know, whether it's a beautiful vaccine or an EV.
Well, and we look at how things are just being forced down our throat. And we understand how the government and the corporations have colluded to lie to us and to manipulate us. And so I think it's it is really, some people are starting to catch on. A lot of people are still blinded by the partisan Hegelian dialectic that's going out there, as we talked about before. But talk a little bit about precious metals. Yeah, I talk frequently about gold and silver here. We got one of our best sponsors is Tony Arterburn with Wise Gold, and he set up DavidKnight.gold. But you're talking about a different kind of precious metal. You said the kind that rolls.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there was a time when I bought my Trans Am, I bought it because I just liked it. You know, I liked the idea of owning a cool muscle car. But as it turns out, it was actually a very good investment. You know, when I bought the thing way back in the early 90s, I think I paid $5,400 for it. Good luck, even adjusted for inflation, trying to find a car like my Trans Am today in that condition for anything remotely approximating that amount of money, even adjusted for Biden bucks. So I've had the fun of owning the car for all these years, but I haven't lost any money on owning a car. Not that I want to sell it, but hypothetically, if I were to sell it, I'd more than make my money back on it. And it's not just these antique cars like my Trans Am. It's older cars that were made during what I like to call the sweet spot of vehicular design, which I consider to be the apotheosis, the moment at which cars had reached a level that they have been declining from ever since, which is roughly the mid-late 90s through roughly about 2010. Mm-hmm. You know, vehicles made during that time are incredibly durable, incredibly reliable. They're relatively easy to maintain. They don't need much maintenance, and they don't have touchscreens. They don't have over-the-top elaborate technology. They don't spy on you. They're not connected to anything. Mm-hmm. And the value of those cars is increasing because people are getting it, and they're not wanting a new car, which is in and of itself kind of unprecedented. It used to be the case people wanted a new car because the new car was an improvement. Yeah. It was better than what you had before. Now it's worse. It's not only more expensive, it's filled with glitchy technology, creepy technology that's watching and listening to what you do in your car and monetizing you. You know, you've become a product. Who wants that? Well, a lot of people don't. And so that's driving the cost of this precious metal, these older cars, up. And I think it's a really good time to invest in it yourself for all these reasons.
Yeah, and of course, talking and nagging you about things, and that's going. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about an article where they were saying, "Well, we're going to put ChatGPT in the car." It's like, no, not that. Anything but that.
I actually wrote about that too. Volkswagen is the leading edge of that particular sphere. They announced about 2 or 3 weeks ago that they're going to include that in all their vehicles. It won't be optional. Wow. So when you buy a Volkswagen vehicle, you're going to have a Chinese AI chatbot riding shotgun with you.
A front seat driver, as I say. That's way worse than a back seat driver nagging you. And then, of course, we had in the wonderful jurisdiction of San Francisco, we had a state rep Wiener there, you know, Wienerland. And he came up with the idea of having governors on the car, so you could have a governor in there with you as well as some kind of.
You know, the worrisome thing about that, you know, ordinarily I would dismiss that as the ravings of a San Francisco leftist lunatic. Mm-hmm. The problem is that kind of thing, it's going to get traction nationally. And what people should understand is that the technology is already embedded in most new cars, to one degree or another.
Yes,
it's just a matter of enabling it, of fully enabling it, I should say. For example, the speed limiter thing. Most new cars have something called speed limit assist technology, and it's marketed as a helpful assistant. You know, a little light comes on the instrument cluster to let you know that you're driving faster than whatever the speed limit is, and then it chimes and cheeps at you. Well, that technology could be kicked up to prevent you from driving any faster, or to let the appropriate authorities, whether they be the government or the insurance mafia, know that you happen to have been driving faster than the speed limit at such and such a time and date, and then done you accordingly. And people should understand that this stuff is not coming. It's already here.
Yes, they have all the technology they need. I talked about that the other day. I said, you know, whenever you look at your map app, if you're using one of those things, it knows exactly what the speed limit is where you are. And as you point out, it's already embedded in the car. They have, you know, they're connected to the cloud in most of these cases now. And so I always did expect that what they were going to do was just to give you a ticket. You know, here's the ticket, you're over the speed limit. And if you don't reduce this, if you're still over the speed limit in another 5 minutes, we'll give you another ticket, that type of thing. But by doing it this way, I guess, you know, by saying it's going to limit you to 10 miles over the speed limit, then they can still have the police force the police union is not going to fight them, you know, for firing people. And so they can still have their cake and eat it too. And so I guess that's maybe what they're looking at. But, you know, that's what we've seen from California, just as they said, well, we're going to stop the sale of any non-electric cars by such and such a date. And you've already got like another, what is it, 7, 8, 9, 10 states that have piggybacked onto this. We had Virginia just get off of the train. But you got all these other ones that said, well, whatever California does, we'll follow them as well.
Yeah. Now, there's an interesting aspect to this, or a facet of it, I should say, that's kind of got a Schadenfreude quality to it. If they do decree that vehicles shall travel no faster than the speed limit, or 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, well, what have they done? They've taken away what is probably the only thing that's appealing about electric cars. You hear it touted about how quick they are, how fast they are. Well, boy, oh boy, I really want to line up to spend $80,000 on a ludicrous speed Tesla that can't go any faster than an 84 Yugo.
But it gets you there so quickly, you know.
They won't let you get to
25 miles an hour. You can get 25 miles an hour no time.
Ask a commercial trucker about this. Yeah. They'll say that you're accelerating aggressively.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
And then that, too, will be verboten or become the pretext for issuing you either an adjustment of your insurance or a ticket. Mm-hmm. Count on it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They can tell you're accelerating too quickly. You're braking too quickly. You're taking the corner too quickly. All the rest of that stuff.
You turned without signaling. I mean, anything and everything, it will be without limit. And that's why it's so important to never give these people an inch of ground. When you're dealing with malignant people, never give them an inch of ground or a moment's grace, because they don't deserve it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'll never forget the ticket that I got for not using my turn signal. And I know exactly what happened with it. I was working late at night at TI, and I'm going home in the wee hours of the morning before everybody's come in to work yet. And I was the only one on the road except for one car that was over to the right. And I saw the light turning yellow, and I was speeded up to go through it. And then I looked at that car more closely, and I saw it was a cop car.
Uh-oh.
And I put my brakes on, and it was a control stop, you know, and I stopped, and I looked over at him, and I smiled like you thought you had me, you know. The next morning when I came in at 8 o'clock, he was waiting for me. And he followed me, and he gave me a ticket for not using my turn signal. And there was no traffic there or anything, you know, to make it to change the lane and everything. So, you know, they have their way of getting even with you, don't they?
Yeah, well, you know, a jerk. But, you know, the thing is, at least that was sort of a random and incidental jerk. What's going to happen now is that these jerks will become electronicized and ubiquitous, and you will not be able to get away from them. Yeah. And you can imagine this kind of panopticon that they want to erect. A digital panopticon where everything that we do is constantly scrutinized, and any deviation from what they say is acceptable or allowed is immediately punished. That's right. The kind of world they want to create for us.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get to it today, but, you know, there's as people are starting to push back against artificial intelligence right now, it's the artist community that says, you know, you're stealing our artwork, you know, for these graphic programs that AI is putting the stuff together. And so they've come up with a program, they call it Nightshade, and they're just getting, you know, millions of downloads with that and the one before it. And because what it does is it puts in random stuff that messes up the artificial intelligence for now, messes it up so that it thinks it's a picture of something completely different than it is. And people don't see it, though. So it's a clever way. So you got to, you know, it's kind of like we've seen over the years with, technology and counter technology, you know, the radar detectors, and then you have the in response to the radar guns, and then they ramp it up to detect the detectors, and you know, that type of
spy versus spy. Remember that?
Yeah, measure and countermeasure and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so now they're doing this with artificial intelligence and artwork. And yet, you know, they look at, even when Travis does thumbnails and stuff like that, if he puts something in there about President Xi, it won't do anything with that. And even with ChatGPT, I had my other son looking at how we could do the outline for the, since the show's 3 hours, we try to get people an idea of the topics in it. And so he gave it a transcript that came out of Premiere, and it really wasn't working with it. So he said, well, here is an example of the transcript. Do it like this. And when he gave it an example of what I cover, it just stopped working with him completely. It doesn't like the topics that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's amazing the biases that are built into these things. And that's what AI is going to be. It's going to be the thing that's going to run this panopticon, that's going to look at everything that we do. It's going to be able to mine all of this information that they've collected about us, all the cameras that are out there. It's going to be able to make sense of it in a way that they just don't have the manpower to do.
Right. And if they can tie this into digital money, the CBDC thing. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, then it's game over for us at that point. And hopefully we'll be spared that. Hopefully enough people will awaken in enough time that there will be sufficient pushback to prevent that from happening. But if not, you won't be able to buy a can of pop out of a vending machine.
That's right.
If you posted some mean tweet.
That's right. Yeah, I just had an interview earlier this week. It was on Wednesday, I think. I talked to Aaron Day, who had been a libertarian activist up in New Hampshire. And he ran for office because he was so concerned about CBDC. That was his only thing. And it allowed him to get in and talk to some candidates and talk to some other people about it. But he wrote a book, exactly what you're talking about, a fictional account of life under CBDC as the first part of it. And then the second part of the book, he talks about what people need to do as individuals, because, you know, the politicians, for the most part, aren't going to do anything about it. They're already on board with all this stuff. And they've been laying the foundation, the groundwork of this stuff for years, just like they did with the vaccine. And so they're ready to roll this stuff out. So he's talking about, you know, what do you do with gold, silver, and crypto in order to try to have, you know, some way to opt out a part of this thing that is coming towards us.
Yeah, I think part of it is having things that you can barter. And that includes, of course, your skill set.
Yeah.
Things that you can do that other people might need that could become valuable in a scenario like that. Mm-hmm. If you're fortunate enough to live in a close-knit, smaller kind of a community where people know one another, that sort of a system becomes much more practicable, because a lot of it is based on trust. We used to have, generally speaking, a high trust society where it was assumed the person that you were dealing with was probably honest and probably competent. You know, you went along with it. You can't assume that anymore. But outside of your small community, that is, in a small community where you know people, you know, I mean, I know my neighbors, they know me. Mm-hmm. I know people in the community, and that's bankable. You know, that's something that's of inestimable value, in my opinion. You know, how do you trade in that currency? It's not something that can be put down on a piece of paper. If you know, that the electrician down the road, and you know him personally, you know he's competent, and, you know, he knows, conversely, you, and that you're able to provide him something of value in exchange, then you don't necessarily need digital money to be able to transact that way.
That's right. Yeah, set up some kind of a barter exchange. You got an article, Are Old Cars Practical as Daily Drivers? I think that's a great idea. And as you were pointing out, you know, the cars that were pre-2010, there's a lot to be said for them in terms of what they don't have, things that are going to encumber you, things that are going to break and be expensive. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, let's define old car. You know, generally, I find when you hear that term bandied about, most people will instinctively think you're talking about a car like my Trans Am, something that was made in the distant past. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily mean cars like that. I actually mean more like the cars that you and I were just talking about. Cars that are fully modern, they just happen to be older. My truck is 22 years old. But unlike a car from the 50s or the 60s or the 70s, it has electronic fuel injection. It's got modern brakes. It's easier to drive in a lot of ways than anything that's brand new, because it doesn't constantly bark at me because I'm doing something that the programming doesn't like. So I can concentrate on my driving. The point being, a car like that is absolutely practical to drive every day. I drive my truck almost every day. I have no problem driving it every day. And there are all kinds of vehicles, practically any vehicle that was made from circa the late 90s all the way through up about 2010 or so. Those are immensely reliable vehicles, and there's no reason at all, you know, is if you're not hung up about driving an older vehicle, that you couldn't go out and buy one of those things and make it your everyday car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, you know, even the people who are hung up on the appearance of something, you know, the older cars are a lot more interesting in the way they look, even if it's quirky, isn't it?
Sure, and they're also not as monstrous. I'll give you a good example. I saw a Toyota Tundra, a circa 2000 model Tundra the other day, and that was it's a full-size truck. It's a half-ton pickup with a V8 engine, and yet it looks about the same size as a current mid-size truck, something like a Chevy Colorado, for example, or a GMC Canyon. And I like the idea of driving something that's not as monstrous as the current half tons, which are preposterous. They're behemoths.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a pretty big guy. And like even a guy my height, I'm 6'3", you know, I can literally not touch the floor of the bed in these trucks without standing on something, you know, a guy my height. And you can't get in and out of the things without, you know, crawling. And they literally are so jacked up and high off the ground now, they have ladders and things built into their tailgate. That's how silly it's gotten.
It is. You know? It is crazy. And you know, and the front, when you walk in front of one of these cars, I mean, they got the grill that goes up to like 7 feet tall, you know?
And it's all made out of plastic. You know, this big rugged He-Man truck, you know, you take it and, you bump into something inadvertently, and now you've got $5,000 worth of damage to the front end.
You know, that makes me think, one thing that surprised me about that video we showed of the Rivian busting through like it was paper, that metal guardrail, and then smashing to bits the first row of concrete that I got. I was surprised that it didn't burst into flames.
Yeah, that was actually quite remarkable. But the thing is, you never know.
Yeah,
you know, the flames might not have erupted immediately. That's another thing. Getting back to the safety thing with these EVs. You know, over time, things degrade. Anything that is a machine, anything that moves, eventually it's going to suffer deterioration. Our bodies suffer deterioration over time. So you've got this battery case and all of the stuff that's inside the battery, those thousands of individual cells. Inevitably, over time, they are going to deteriorate. And as they deteriorate, the increased risk of fire attends that. Now, we won't know yet because they haven't been in mass circulation yet. Give it time, though, and I think we're going to start to see even more fires. And one of the reasons, to get back to your thing, about your point about the Rivian, one of the reasons why EVs are often totaled after a much less serious impact than the one that we see in that video is because there's really no practical way to determine whether the battery case was damaged.
That's right.
You'd have to remove it, disassemble it, and inspect it. And rather than do that, because it's cost prohibitive, the insurance company will simply total the vehicle, cut a check, and of course, you and I get to pay for that because these costs end up being distributed across everybody who has to pay for insurance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like the guy who was driving his Tesla by himself. He said, normally, you know, I would have had my kid in a car seat, my wife in there, but all of a sudden the thing just started, you know, caught fire, and he pulls it over. He jumps out just in time. He said, if I'd had my wife and if I'd had the kid in the back, they wouldn't have been able to get out. And so, you know, it can be very unpredictable. Was it something that was it damaged? Was it a factory defect? Did he have a situation where he ran over something that was on the road and maybe it, you know, dinged something because the batteries are underneath the car. Maybe it dinged something down there. And it just took a while for that to propagate out. Who knows?
There's little that the owner can do to mitigate these risks with the electric cars, which stands in stark contrast to what you or I could do to mitigate the risks of a fire with our vehicle. You know, you check and see, well, I noticed a gas leak. Well, I better do something about that. You know, these things are physical and visible, and you can see them. And if you're not a complete idiot, you know not to, you know, light a match to have a look under the hood to see, you know, whether there's a leak there. These are the ways that you prevent the non-electric car from going up in smoke. But when it comes to a battery-powered vehicle, it's nothing. You just assume. You have to kind of take it as an article of faith. Well, I hope today it doesn't burn up, and I hope today it doesn't take out my garage and my house along with it and kill me and my family in our sleep.
You've got an interesting article. I love when you do this. Again, going back to some of the old cars, you know, is it practical to have an old car as a daily driver? You know, precious metals, you know, the fact that some of them retain their value and actually go up significantly if it's an unusual car. You also have one called How Times Have Changed. It began with that other electric thing that used to start fires, and and that's a cigarette lighter in the car. And how we don't have those anymore, pretty much, because people aren't smoking cigarettes, I guess, anymore. So
more like burns. You know, it used to be, you know, if you went shopping for a used car back in the day, you'd sometimes see a little burn on the plastic center console where somebody's cigarette ash dropped. But it was common for cars to have not one, but several ashtrays, plus the cigarette lighter itself. Now they have power points, you know, because it's politically incorrect to smoke now. So, you know, you don't have that in cars any longer. And I try not to be a Luddite about this stuff. I just also think, though, that sometimes progress is not necessarily for the best. And some of the other examples that I put in there are the shift away from sealed beam glass headlights to these plastic headlight assemblies. Mm-hmm. Plastic is cheap until it breaks, and then it's really expensive to replace it.
Yeah.
Whereas those sealed beam lights never yellowed, and they would only crack if you hit it with something. Mm-hmm. So what's the advantage? Well, you've got increased illumination, but frankly, you know, a set of halogen lights are pretty doggone good, and they don't blind oncoming traffic either.
Yeah.
So I don't know if necessarily it's been an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, you know, first they took away the full-size spare tire. So, you know, they gave you a space saver, one of these little mini spare donut things in place of a spare. But at least you could kind of limp on down the road on one of those things and get you where, you know, you might get some help. Now they're taking that away. Now you don't even get the space saver tire anymore. What you get is an inflator kit. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the inflator kit is if there's damage to the sidewall, which happens a lot nowadays because of the short sidewalls that they have and the high inflation pressures and the big wheels. And so you hit a pothole and it ruptures the sidewall. Well, that's not going to fix your sidewall. So now you're stuck. And now, if you've experienced the wonders of roadside service lately, you'll know that sometimes you'll be sitting there for 2 or 3 hours waiting for the truck to show up. So what's been gained?
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, they did that. And the first car I had with that was my Miata. And of course, there wasn't any room really for a tire much. And so it was an inflator kit with that. And I guess more useful than that is having a AAA number that you could call. Just wait.
Yeah, I tell people, particularly, and this is going to be a patriarchal sexist comment, but you know, if you have a daughter or if your wife is going to be driving by herself, I encourage people to consider getting a full-size spare for the vehicle that they have and keeping that thing in the trunk for just in case, as opposed to the inflator kit, as opposed to the space saver tire, because you can actually get back on the road then, as opposed to being stuck by the side of the road in a potentially not very safe place, which these days in this disintegrating country seems to be practically everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Another one you got along with the older cars is what we don't do anymore. What we don't do anymore with our cars. What do you have in mind with that?
You know, you're going to have to remind me. I'm having a single moment.
What most of us don't do anymore, and you've got, the other day I used my old muscle car. It's something that we never did, which was the choke, and that's what got my attention.
Ah, yes.
Because I had, my second car was a 1974 Triumph Spitfire.
Yes.
And it had a choke, and I thought that was the most hysterical thing. I mean, even in 1974, you really didn't see chokes there, except on like a lawnmower, and it's like, this was the thing got a lawnmower engine?
No,
like,
but you did see them. You just didn't have them, generally, you didn't have to pull them out mechanically. You remember until the 80s. What you did to start a car if it was cold was you push down on the gas pedal, and that set the choke on the carburetor.
Yeah.
You know, it might have been mechanical or electrical, but you still had a choke. You know, you didn't just get in. If you just got in, like with a modern car, you just get in and turn the key, or rather, with most modern cars, you push a button, you know, to start the car. Well, back in the day, the first thing that you would do is pump the gas pedal, which did two things actually. First, it set the choke, and it shot a little bit of gas into the engine. If you didn't do either of those things, you just turn the key and nothing, it would just spin. It wouldn't start because choke's off and there's not enough gas to get the engine going. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that we don't do anymore in new cars.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember that. I remember pumping the gas and, my mom pumping it too much, for example, flying the thing so that he could smell the gas and it wouldn't start that way either. I just thought it was funny on my Spitfire because it had, and of course, you know, being a British Leyland car, the choke itself was a plastic thing that was flimsy, felt like it was going to break off in your hand as you pulled it out, you know, so it really was an interesting experience because everything in it was really pretty primitive and pretty raw. And that kind of made it fun, you know, that had this one layer of top on it that when it rained, and it would rain every afternoon pretty heavily in Tampa where I lived at the time, when it would rain, I mean, you were like you were in a tent, you know, and it even leaked a bit like a tent would.
Speaking of things that are quaint and British, do you know what, here's a phrase for you, tickling the amyls. You know what that is?
The what? Say again?
Tickling the amyls.
No, I don't know what that is. What is that?
If you had an old Triumph motorcycle, they had amyl carburetors, and it was, the process was called tickling the carburetor, which was essentially you're pushing this little button to shoot some gas into the thing so it'll start when you kick it.
That's funny. Speaking of motorcycles, this is another one of your articles. You're talking about next they're going to come for the motorcycles, and of course, sure, I can certainly see that happening. They just came at the, as of January the 1st in California. They came after the, you know, gasoline lawn mowers and blowers and all the rest of the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, if motorcycles were a new technology, they would never allow them on the roads. You know, they would say they're unsafe. And they're going to go after them. They already are going after them. It's just a lag time built into them relative to cars with regard to emissions. You know, they had managed to, quote unquote, get away with it up until now, because motorcycles are a relatively small proportion of the nation's vehicle fleet. And of course, motorcycle engines are smaller than car engines, generally speaking, though that's not so much true anymore as engines get smaller and smaller in cars. Mm-hmm. They haven't been as scrutinized as car engines have. But, you know, all the stuff that happened to cars is happening to bikes. You know, they've now got catalytic converters and O2 sensors and fuel injection and electronic controls and all the stuff that's making them more expensive and more complicated, just like cars. And inevitably, they're going to push air-cooled engines off the market, just like they did with cars. It's harder to dial in an air-cooled engine. There's more temperature variation. And so the result of that is that emissions aren't as compliant as they need to be for the federal standards. So you're going to end up with, you know, water-cooled bikes only. That's going to get rid of a lot of Harley-Davidson type bikes, for example. Mm-hmm. And they're just going to end up with this same kind of dynamic that they have had with cars, where pretty much they're going to push electric power onto motorcycles. They're trying to do that. They're trying to get people acclimated to the idea of getting on this thing that looks like a motorcycle, but it isn't a motorcycle. It has, you know, it has no transmission. You don't shift. You sit there on it, you rotate the grip, and it moves. And then it runs out of range after a while, and then you wait. And that's what they've got in mind for that, too.
You know, it is interesting, too, because as they go to electric bikes, maybe they haven't noticed what's happening to all these e-bikes in the cities and all the fires that they're having in New York City. Yes. People that have been killed by that. I mean, it's a, you know, again, same problem. We just keep seeing it scaled up, you know, whether it's a bike or whether it's a bus. And of course, the big bus, electric bus companies, the cities that have bought into that, to Virtue Signal, are seeing that 50% or more of their fleet are out, even though they paid many times what they would for a diesel bus. So, you know, this is happening everywhere. Canada, they can't get them to work because it's too cold. And so they're going back to diesel there. But in Germany, they had some that just spontaneously combusted, took out everything at the Stuttgart place. So, you know, as you scale this thing, we've seen it with the Samsung phones. They had problems with lithium batteries. But you just scale it up from that to a scooter, to a motorcycle, to a car, to a bus, to a semi-truck. You know, I mean, it just, there is no... Nobody, finally now, the reality is setting in on people, as I said, you know, they're starting to pull back on it, but there just seems to be this, full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes attitude.
Yeah, I hope people begin to see the common thread, which is an anti-personal mobility, anti-driving, anti-vehicle ownership thread. That is how you understand what's going on. And if you take that as the premise of your thinking, everything begins to make sense. Otherwise, it doesn't. You know, otherwise, it's really baffling and puzzling. You look at it and go, well, why in the world would they do this? It's inefficient. It's expensive. It is causing problems for people. It's unsafe. It's dangerous. All these things. Well, it makes sense if you look at it through that prism and understand that the end goal here is to get you and I and the majority of people who aren't John Kerry and Joe Biden out from behind the wheel and into some kind of government-approved transportation.
That's right. And government-controlled transportation. Before you came on, I was just talking about an article that I saw in the Washington Examiner where the writer was saying, well, I hope that, it seems like, I don't know, these people learned their lesson, these leaders who put us into this lockdown, all the rest of stuff. It's like, are you kidding me? It worked out perfectly fine for them. They didn't. Yeah, this is exactly what they wanted. It's just like the products of the school system are exactly what they want. And that's the crazy thing, is that people still don't understand, even though we went through all that, they don't understand what the end goal is here. And so they obviously don't see that all these different things that they're trying to scare us about all have the same end goal.
I think they don't understand it precisely because they're sane and normal. And I think it's very difficult. It's funny, but that's also true. Alarming. I think that the average person has a really difficult time. I know it took me a long time to understand these malignant people, to understand what you're dealing with, that it's not about good intentions gone awry. It's not about, they're just incompetent. These people are consciously, deliberately malignant people. And that's a difficult thing for most people to really come to terms with and understand.
And I think you combine that. And I've said this in the past. I said, because we're normal, we can't understand these people's mindset. And because we haven't seen the technology, we don't understand how powerful that technology is. And that's a really explosive binary bomb. When you take these psychopaths and you give them unlimited amounts of money and technology that can do things that we can't even imagine, we still think it's sci-fi stuff. That's what's really we're looking at. And that's what makes us so dangerous. But just pulling back. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, got the cat. Just for people who question whether I'm me being perhaps a little hyperbolic about the malignant thing, stop to consider that all of the people behind the pandemic, Fauci, Burks, all those people, Trump, none of them have evinced any public shame. None of them have come forward and said, I feel terrible. I wish I had done something differently. I meant well. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. You never hear that from any of these people ever about anything. They just don't care.
Yes. And a couple of weeks ago, I did a video that I saw where Luke Radowski was talking to Tim Pool, and he says, why can't they just admit that they did something wrong? Maybe then we could start to fix it, fix some of the things, make sure this doesn't happen again. And Tim Pool just went off on him. I am so sick and tired of hearing this for 4 years. They did a thing 4 years ago. So what? And it's like, are you kidding me? These are the same people, by the way, on the right, who are still talking about every little minute detail of the election, but they don't want to talk about the lockdowns and the vaccines or any of the rest of that stuff. Hey, it's 4 years ago. Let's just move on. That's the damaging thing that we see. And that's coming from a lot of the alternative media.
They will hound some 98-year-old guy who, when he was a 16-year-old kid, worked for a month at the end of the war at Treblinka. Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to forget that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that person should be forgiven. People should be held account for what they do if they've done something horrific and something appalling. But somehow we're just supposed to pretend that all this stuff didn't happen. Now, me personally, if I'd been involved in something that had caused a lot of damage to people, to their livelihood, to their health, I don't think I could live with myself. I would want forgiveness. I would want to apologize and say, look, man, I was scared. I meant well. I was trying to do the right thing and I screwed up and I'm sorry. Yeah. I could roll with that. If these people would come out and say something like that, I could roll with that, but they don't say that. So that tells me a lot about who they really are.
That's right. They knew when they were doing it, right? They knew what was happening, that they knew that this was a hospital death protocol, putting people on these ventilators, but they did it anyway because they're getting paid to do it by Trump's government. That's the key thing. As we're talking about this attack on ownership, there was something I talked about earlier this week that I think is amazing. You and I have talked so many times about CO2 and what a tiny percentage of the atmosphere it is. And during these, during the Iowa caucus, it came up that they've got this ludicrous idea of pumping CO2 across the continent in a pipeline. And the only thing that compounds all that is the it's compounded by the fact that they want to combine that with eminent domain to steal people's farms. Yeah. And that you've got all these politicians that are involved in it, right? You got the guy who owns Summit, which is the CO2 company. He's big fan and supporter and donor of Trump at Mar-a-Lago and all the rest of this stuff. And then you've got Kristi Noem in South Dakota and Governor Burgum, another Republican in North Dakota, where they want to store a lot of this stuff. They're all on board with it as well. And it's amazing and disgusting to see these people who have absolutely no regard for our private property. But everything we've been talking about is along those lines. You have these globalist elite, they're going to own everything. We're going to own nothing. And that's just another absurd aspect of it. And when I talked about it, I said it's like Spaceballs, where the character's got Perry Air. He's got that canned air.
And he puts they've got a great regard for their net worth. It's just become so cynical, on both sides, which are really the same side, left, right, it's the same thing ultimately. They are profiteers. You know, these people realize that they can make as much money off of this green scam as the people on the left. Yeah, sure, let's have a big company that makes a pipeline and steal people's land. I'll get rich. I'll have my, I'll have my doomsday bunker somewhere in Maui because I'll have all this money. They just don't care. It's all about them, their money, and their power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was the insanity, the lunacy of all this stuff. The idiocracy that we live in was compounded by the fact you had people in the areas where they're going to be putting the carbon dioxide into the ground. They're freaking out and said, what if that leaks out? It's like, what if it does? Who cares if it does? And that's why we got to start laughing at this whole paranoia about CO2.
I will say, Vivek Ramaswamy was the only one of the GOP fold to come out openly and say that the whole thing is a scam.
Yeah,
the whole thing is a grift. Only one.
Yeah,
and all these other guys, they implicitly buy into it. I mean, after all, it must be true. If we have to have a way to sequester carbon, then carbon must be a dangerous gas, carbon dioxide, right?
Yeah.
So they agreed with the left. So how do you oppose the left by agreeing with the left?
Exactly. Yeah, you gotta attack it at that point. You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, when you look at these people and they freak out about it, there's so much confusion with people over carbon dioxide versus carbon monoxide. Maybe that's what they thought, right? We're all going to die in our homes just like we were in a car in a garage with the motor turned on and the door down, you know? If all this stuff gets out, we could all die. So, but
even with regard to that, it's actually quite difficult to kill yourself with a running car in a closed garage now because they're so clean. So little pollution. You almost have to literally put your mouth on the tailpipe in order to get the lethal dose in any kind of time.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, and I know that from experience. I mean, when I'm driving around with the top down, used to be that, you would, get in behind a car that needed a tune-up or something.
And your eyes would water.
Yeah, but you don't have that anymore. Never see that anymore. Even when you get behind old cars, I mean, it's very, very, very rare. It's so rare that when it happens, it's like, oh yeah, I remember this.
by any objective rational standard, the pollution problem as it pertains to vehicle exhaust emissions was solved about 1998.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, we are arguing about how many angels fit on the head of a pin, but the trillions of dollars that are being spent on this and the ability that they have to control us through these so-called treaties. And that's one of the things that bothers me. This Paris treaty never ratified. Nobody in either party ever said, well, you know how this works. The Senate is supposed to have a vote to have a treaty, and yet they hold that over our heads. And so, as I've said, we already have global governance because we have all these people on both parties have consented to allow these globalist organizations to set the agenda and then pretend that they have to obey it and march in lockstep. And that's exactly
the Constitution is an effective nullity. You know, whatever happened to the constitutional requirement that Congress shall declare war when that is deemed to be necessary. Mm-hmm. Now we just have the decider, whether it's Bush or Biden, or Trump. They just decide and they decree and they send us off to war.
That's right. Yeah, it's all done by fiat. And we see this being done with everything. Just I began the program today talking about the fact that yet here we are on Groundhog Day. We got yet another executive order and yet another attempt at gun control coming from Biden. Well, where did that get established? And so many, Fox and all these conservative organizations that are appealing to a conservative group, they want to talk about how bad Biden is for doing gun control. But they don't look at the fact that Trump did it with a bump stock and even did it with a pistol brace. And so this is the way that they control people. It's, again, through this hyper-partisanship. And if we can't see, if we are so partisan that we blind ourselves to what these people do and have done, there really isn't any hope for us at this point.
I agree.
Yeah.
Thoughtfulness is in narrow supply and much need these days, isn't it? Just thinking about it, reflecting on it, looking at the facts and coming to a judgment instead of this, as you say, reflexively knee-jerk partisan reaction. You know, it's a team blue and team red. We all know
what
to do.
That's right. Well, that's why I like your publication, Eric Peters Auto. He cuts through it. He's not partisan, and his focus is on liberty and mobility, and you can't separate those things, as I'm sure Jefferson would have said if he'd owned a car right now. What's that? Thank you so much for joining us. And those are two things that you can destroy, but you cannot disjoin, I think is probably what Jefferson would have said. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening.
David Knight Show is a critical thinking super spreader. If you've been exposed to logic by listening to the David Knight Show, please do your part and try not to spread it. Financial support or simply telling others about the show causes this dangerous information to spread farther. People have to trust me. I mean, trust the science. Wear your mask. Take your vaccine. Don't ask questions.
Using free speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.